Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming along. Can I also thank the Centre for Policy Studies for hosting us this morning, and to Robert for that rather rare introduction. Now, everyone knows that the Centre for Policy Studies matters, and not just for Conservatives, but for politics as a whole. Robert, Alex Morton, the rest of the team here are producing exceptional work, and Westminster is sitting up and taking note. So for the CPS, I'm confident the future is bright. And today I want to explain why the future is bright for Britain too. I should start by acknowledging that my optimism is not universally shared at this particular juncture in history by everyone in Westminster. Project Fear has gone from being a campaign tactic to a major manufacturing industry. But I believe that such alarmism is unwarranted and that it is obscuring the strong underlying fundamentals that give the UK a significant comparative advantage as we leave the European Union. And that insight became even clearer to me when I served as Brexit Secretary. We are in a stronger position than our detractors suggest. And that's one reason I will vote against the government's withdrawal agreement. Because simply put, it's a bad deal and Britain can do better. Now, I look forward to speaking tomorrow in the debate and contributing along with MPs from all different parts of the political spectrum and with very different views. And however much we may disagree on the substance, I do think we need to listen and respect each other's different points of view. In the words of the great John Stuart Mill, he who knows only his side of the case knows little of that. And I can say I, for one, was appalled at the intimidation and abuse meted out to Anna Soubry when she was interviewed by Sky News last week. And I do think it's the responsibility for us as politicians to take a lead in showing that even in such vexed questions like Brexit, and even with people holding different but very deeply held political convictions, they can be put forward with both passion and respect. With that in mind, today I'd like to offer an answer to one of the questions which is often asked of Brexiteers like me. And I think it's a perfectly reasonable question. It's a legitimate challenge to ask, what is your vision of post-Brexit Britain? How will it work? Who will it serve? For my part, I'm convinced that our sights must focus on the long-term best interests of this country, and that our judgment must carefully balance the undoubted risks of Brexit with the clear opportunities it also offers. We have no cause for complacency, but we have every reason for self-confidence. After all, back in December, the UK was rated best country for business by Forbes magazine for the second year in a row since the referendum. According to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development in the first half of 2018, the UK attracted the second largest amount of foreign direct investment in the world, second only to China. Data published just last week by London and Partners shows that in 2018, London attracted almost double the tech venture capital of its next nearest EU rival, which was Berlin. Now, I know our critics say that Brexiteers who want to keep faith with the referendum are chasing unicorns. Well, I'll just point out that the latest data from the consultancy Deal Room shows that London is indeed home to 36 unicorns, the tech companies valued at over $1 billion, streets ahead of any other EU city. I'm proud of our tech unicorns and their entrepreneurial self-belief. And as a country, I believe we should rise to the challenge we face with economic self-belief. So I'm optimistic about our economy. I'm also optimistic about the political battle of ideas. I think it's there to be won for my party, for those of us who believe in the power of free enterprise to create the opportunities of the future, especially for the next generation. A poll of millennials commissioned last April here at the Centre for Policy Studies found that younger voters believe government taxes and spends too much. They want a society based on equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome. 4 out of 5 were not sold on the socialist snake oil being peddled by Jeremy Corbyn. But they need to be told to hear a positive, optimistic and authentic alternative to that seductive Marxist allure. And as a pro-enterprise party, we Conservatives, we've got to have the courage of our convictions and take a positive, aspirational and credible prospectus to that generation of younger voters. Brexit's going to be a crucial part of that prospectus for younger voters, but also for the country at large. And one important reason I'm going to vote against the deal tomorrow is I believe it would choke off the opportunities of Brexit. Take the government's commitment to make the UK a global leader in free trade, which I welcome. In practice, that will be impossible if we give up such wide-ranging control over regulation and our ability to lower tariffs and conduct an independent trade policy. That's what the deal demands, and I believe Britain can do better than that. The EU itself, its commission, estimates 90% of the world's economic growth will come from outside of the EU by next year. And I saw it for myself when I was a Foreign Office lawyer between 2000 and 2006, when I negotiated investment protection and promotion agreements from Mexico through to Iran. Incidentally, the EU has grabbed power over that area of competence too since that time. But what always really excited me was thinking about what expanding investment and trade would really mean for the startup looking to scale up by selling their product or service to a new market. For the consumers here at home who benefit from a wider range of cheaper goods in the stores. For the 21st century, we will need to have broader global horizons and the freedom to take advantage of those opportunities from Latin America right the way across to Asia. Why does free trade matter? Well, first, it's an important way to boost SMEs. Take Indigo, which is a warehouse and logistics software firm based up in Durham that is grasping new opportunities in Southeast Asia. So back in 2016, the CEO of Indigo, Darren Baxter, saw, in his words, the stagnant growth in Europe, and he identified what he called the untapped demand in Southeast Asia among a wide range of high-growth local businesses ripe for UK-based developers of technology solutions. Today, Indigo has a team in the Philippines, which is also serving clients from Hong Kong through to Singapore. A liberal, dynamic, and energetic approach to free trade will reduce barriers and expand opportunities for other SMEs, like Indigo, to take full advantage of the international export opportunities available, which Brexit can expand and promote if we're ready to grasp the opportunities that it offers. And that will help businesses to create more jobs in innovative sectors like tech. Now, I'm not in the business of bashing big business, but I do think that in the political debates we have here in Westminster, the value, the relevance, and the scale of what SMEs produce is too often neglected. This isn't some wistful sentimentalism. It's raw economic common sense. SMEs have created 72% of the new jobs in the private sector since 2010. 72%, it's almost three quarters. Expanding their global opportunities will help them create the better paid jobs for the future, for the next generation. And overall, according to the ONS, businesses that trade internationally are a fifth more productive than those that don't. 20%. 20% more productive. So free trade is not just good for businesses, startups, SMEs, but through high productivity, it will help boost workers' wages at home too. Above all, free trade benefits consumers by reducing prices in the shops and giving consumers wider choice. Whether it's the EU's 17% tariff on most shoes or the 12% tariff on knitted baby clothes, Britain can do better, freed from this unnecessary and damaging protectionism. And it's the average working family who will benefit if we remove the tariffs, which represent, bluntly and in their world, an extra tax on the cost of living. Of course, free trade brings benefits for those we sell to and buy from as well. And that's as it should be. In fact, I don't think I can emphasise this point enough. Free trade is not a zero-sum game. We should relish the chance to be a force for good in the world, liberalising trade in particular to help the very poorest countries sell their goods and services, stand on their own two feet, the surest route to real, genuine economic independence. The EU is a handbrake on our ambition in that regard. Let me give you an example. Take the Maldives. Now, they can export their tuna for free into the EU, but they face a whopping 24% tariff if they have the temerity to can it in a factory at home rather than letting the EU process it. Now, that's plainly unfair. So it's little wonder that the ambassador of the Maldives to the UK, Ahmed Shian, extols the opportunities that Brexit and deeper free trade offers his country, let alone ours. The development economist Paul Collier has proposed some really interesting and innovative ways in which the UK post-Brexit can boost its trade policy to help support poorer countries by extending the scope of the Everything But Arms policy to cover some of the EU's protectionist exemptions, and by revising the rules of origin to reflect wider global practice, which would help poorer countries to build up their industrial base. That's who free trade is for. The SMEs creating the jobs of the future, the worker who wants a pay rise, the family on the low income struggling with the cost of living, and the very poorest countries in the world who suffer from hypocritical Western protectionists. And that's whose side we, as a government, and I feel as Conservatives, must be on as we chart our course for post-Brexit Britain. Now, if we're going to be buccaneering free traders abroad, we need to be relentlessly pro-competition here at home, taking on the homegrown vested interests that weren't caused by Brussels, but which echoed around the debate on Brexit and which hold Britain back. Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell offer a deeply damaging and counterproductive economic policy: nationalisation, higher taxes, wider state intervention. But they have tapped a vein of public support in their accusations of crony capitalism and markets rigged by vested interests, all part of an exploitative and unaccountable elite. There is at least an element of truth in the charge, even if Labour's policy prescriptions would hurt the very working families that they say they want to protect. Now, I started my career training as a competition lawyer at Linklaters, both in London and in Brussels, and I advise businesses, large as well as smaller businesses. And I learned that whenever the charge of rigged markets stuck, it was invariably the result of a poverty of proper competition. Today, too often, consumers are being ripped off because the market is in the vice-like grip of a small number of big businesses. That's why I believe the Conservative answer should not be the big clunking fist of state intervention, but a robust and rigorous pro-competition approach to preserve a genuinely free market. The Conservative answer must not ape Labour or offer some diluted version of John McDonnell's radical agenda for state intervention. That would just dilute the harm and breathe life into a stale and broken narrative that has been tested to destruction from 1970s Britain to modern-day Venezuela. Instead, we must offer a credible, authentic, and positive agenda, a positive alternative steeped in the economic values that underpin the enterprise economy, and steeped in the political values that forged the Conservative Party into a winning electoral machine by uniting the aspirational working and middle classes in this country. So yes, we need change to build a better economy. And by levelling the playing field, breaking down barriers to entry, encouraging challenger businesses in monopolised sectors, we can strengthen consumer clout. Preserving the integrity of the free market is the best way to crush crony capitalism, to cut prices and expand choices for consumers, to ease the cost of living for low and middle income families. That's why I believe in the free market. Take energy bills, just one example, but one of the most gummed up markets in the economy, where consumers are regularly ripped off. This month, the government has intervened to cap energy prices, and that carries risks, deterring new challengers onto the market, and Which magazine point to a 90% reduction in cheap energy deals in the year leading up to the cap as evidence of the potential harm to consumers. A better pro-competition policy, backed by people like Oxford University's energy professor Dieter Helm, is to promote, not deter, switching of energy providers by requiring firms to publish very clearly the constituent parts of their standard variable tariff energy bill. Now, those bills comprise four elements. First, the wholesale costs of the energy. Second, the cost of transmission and distribution. Then, thirdly, you've got the taxes and the levies that government imposes on top of them. And then finally, the cost of the metering and the billing. That final fourth element, the metering and the billing, is the only element on which energy firms actually, in practice, compete. So all suppliers should be required to transparently display the cost of the service they are actually providing, and it should be displayed on Ofgem's website. And that is a better way to promote the competition between providers that will give consumers greater clout by enabling them to switch to cheaper deals. Switching is by far in the way, the best way, for consumers to save money. So just to put some meat on the bones, if you compare the estimated £76 saving from the government's cap, Ofgem estimate that switching would save the average standard variable tariff customer £320 each year. That is a massive saving for the consumer. Another classic consumer rip-off is the practice by which some mobile phone operators automatically renew their consumers on contracts that duplicate the initial cost of the handset. Now, if you look at research that Citizens Advice did in 2017, they found that over a third of customers with bills and phone contracts, which included the handset in the initial contract, were rolled over on the same contract at the end of their fixed period, with the cost to them at an average of something like £22 each month, though rising to much more than that and close to £50 in some cases. The total cost of this practice, just to give you some sense of scale, is £130 million each year. The consumer is being diddled to that extent each year. Now, we could change that if we required operators to make clear on their monthly bills the cost of any handset separately from the network charges. And it would help eliminate this sharp practice and give those customers a fairer deal. And again, and this is the theme that I want to talk about, requiring transparency, promoting consumer power, rather than clumsy state intervention, is the most effective way to stamp out consumer rip-offs. And in my submission that I made to the government's 2018 Green Paper, Modernising Consumer Markets, I set out some further reforms for the banking sector, broadband, and currency exchange sectors. But think just for a moment about what all this means in real terms for those struggling to make ends meet. I'm not saying it's a lottery windfall, but these reforms are not small change for the student trying to get on with a grant and a student loan, for the graduate trying to hold down a first job and pay the rent. These people are being stung by up to, in some cases, almost £50 each month over the odds on their mobile phone bill. Likewise, these reforms could make all the difference to the pensioners battening down the hatches, who are paying over £300 each year, more than they should, on their gas and electricity bills. These reforms will make a real difference to them. Now, beyond the specific sectors that I've touched on, we should also strengthen the powers and the mandate of the Competition and Markets Authority. The CMA is going to be a really vital institution for post-Brexit Britain. But right now, it's disproportionately focused on scrutinising mergers between big corporations. And of course, that's really important work. But I'd like to see a broader duty to investigate all anti-competitive conduct in the marketplace, including a power to issue anti-competitive behaviour orders, or ACBOs, against firms ripping off consumers with large fines for breach. If we're serious about preserving the freedoms of the market, they must be properly defended in the interest of healthy competition between businesses and active consumers. That's who the free market is there to serve. The student, the pensioner, the family buying foreign currency exchange to go on that hard-earned holiday. I want us to defend the realm of the free market by guaranteeing that the consumer is king. And that's whose side I'm on as a Conservative. I want to see the Conservatives viewed as the party of healthy and value-conscious consumerism. For the people checking out Money Supermarket online. For those readers of Which magazine, combining transparency, competition and technology to deliver better deals for them. We can save low and middle income families hundreds of pounds each year without costing the Treasury a single penny. Come to think of it, it's not such a bad political offer either. So we can do better. And I know Britain can do better. At the same time, I think we should acknowledge the many successes in government. I'm proud of the Conservatives' record of job creation, cutting taxes, particularly for the lowest paid, and introducing the national living wage. If anything, we should shout even louder about our record and the huge strides made since 2010, including cutting youth unemployment from over 20% to 11.5%. That means today there are 440,000 fewer young people out of work. And having brought unemployment down to record lows, we can do more for those who are still feeling the pinch of the cost of living. I'm thinking here of the 21-year-old fresh out of university, struggling to rent, let alone save for a deposit. I'm thinking of the young couple, both working their socks off, doing the right thing, but struggling with the cost of childcare. So when we consider further Conservative tax cutting priorities, our first priority must be those struggling and striving, those who want to get on. Now, I've long believed, and I still believe, that we should raise the National Insurance employee contribution threshold to £11,850, which would be in line with the personal allowance for income tax. That would save someone earning £15,000 on a low wage, £412 each year. It's an idea that's been backed here by the Centre for Policy Studies with some of their innovative and pioneering work on tax cuts for the lowest paid. It's been backed by the Institute for Fiscal Studies and the Resolution Foundation as a more targeted tax cut for the lowest paid. And that should be our priority as Conservatives. Beyond national insurance, I think we should aim to take a penny off the basic rate of income tax at yearly intervals, reducing it from 20% to 15% over time to boost the pay packets of low and middle income families. They're the people that must benefit from the next wave of Conservative tax cuts. They're the people who right now need to know that we're on their sides. And finally, if capitalism is there to work for the economic little guy in post-Brexit Britain, it must also serve the shareholder. Supporters of free trade like me should feel just as frustrated as the anti-capitalist protesters at the extortionate rewards for executive failure, whether it's Fred Goodwin or Sir Philip Green, because it drains investment, warps the money going into firms, undermines both the competitiveness and the public's confidence in our economy. Beyond the bad behaviour of particular individuals, the root problem here is that investors have outgrown the traditional corporate model. With the increase in the number of people owning shares, the role of institutional investors, the fact that shareholders are now, for many firms, scattered all around the world. In many ways, that's good news. It's a really positive development. But shareholders just don't exercise the same level of grip or accountability as they used to. The relationship, if you like, between the board and shareholders has frayed, and it does need to be repaired. But I believe it should be done by shareholders, not bureaucrats, let alone politicians. And there's quite a lot of practice from Switzerland to the US that we can learn from in this regard. So one way to encourage stronger shareholder activism is by legislating to empower shareholders to vote on individual executive pay packets, not just wider pay remuneration policy, and to make those votes binding. That's something I think we should take up. With new modes of IT, flexible use of extraordinary general meetings, teleconferencing, e-voting, this could be made to work even in the fastest moving business environments, even where recruitment decisions need to be made very swiftly. Likewise, I think we should follow the US precedent by requiring clawback policies so shareholders can recover pay and bonuses that may be paid to incompetent executives on the basis of either flawed information or where directors are responsible for misconduct that causes serious financial loss. It's currently voluntary in this country. It should be made mandatory. And finally, since we're regularly touting the virtues of a flexible labour market, I as a free marketeer and as a conservative, I think we should do that a bit more consistently and see shareholders empowered to sack incompetent or underperforming chief executives without a requirement for them to be paid more than their contractual notice, without a golden goodbye. If we're serious about preserving the free market, if we're serious about avoiding tainting of capitalism, then promoting more robust shareholder accountability is a far more potent tool than crude state intervention. Ladies and gentlemen, Brexit will bring enormous opportunities that are there for us to grasp. And that spirit of renewal must also galvanise us to tackle some of the homegrown problems and challenges around an authentic and credible policy agenda, one which never forgets that the central driving purpose of the enterprise economy, of capitalism itself, is that it serves the interests of ordinary working people in this country far better than any other system. But it can only do that by standing up squarely on the side of the startup, the shareholder, the worker, and the consumer. That's how we can deliver a better Brexit. That's how we can create a better economy. And by offering Britain a brighter future, that's how we can save our country from a hard left Labour government. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dom. Dom has generously agreed to take some questions. My colleagues will be coming around with the microphones.
Thank you. I'm Ben Glaze from the Daily Mirror. You said you'll vote against the PM's deal tomorrow night. Do you think the 17.5 million people who voted for Brexit will thank you if you end up sacrificing your withdrawal on the altar of ideological purity? And a second, if I may, the Prime Minister said she won't fight another general election. Would you like to be the next party leader?
So on the party leadership, I don't get drawn into all of that. We've got a big decision coming up tomorrow. I want us to be focused on Britain and the future for our country. And the point I've made is that I don't accept the assumptions in your questions, although I understand the way you put it, because I think there is a better, brighter alternative than this deal. And I think if people want that better, brighter deal, and for the voters that came out in response and gave us and delivered the biggest democratic mandate we've ever seen in this country, at least in modern history, for change, to deliver Brexit, I think we've got to vote down that deal. And there is an alternative, not just approach to the negotiations, but an alternative, bright, optimistic and positive vision for post-Brexit Britain. And that's what I've hoped to set out for you all today.
Hi, Arj Singh from HuffPost. Last month you said you had no confidence in the Prime Minister. Do you still think that?
Well, we had the vote on that. The Prime Minister's authority was upheld with the vote, and I think we move on. I'm looking forward, not backwards, and that's why I want to see both address the Brexit issue, which we're obviously grappling with tomorrow, but also lay out a long-term positive aspirational future for the country and talk about who it's there for. So we're going to make this work as best we can, but I want to be very clear that there is an optimistic alternative and vision for Brexit, which is not the rather defeatist approach in the government's proposed deal.
Mr. Robb, Ross Campbell from Talk Radio. Theresa May has just outlined in Stoke her letter, exchange of letter with EU leaders. Do you think that she could have achieved more than this in the month that she's delayed the vote by? And if so, what could she have achieved in your view, having been right at the heart of this process?
Well, I think, as I've said before, we should have taken a more resolute approach early on. But the reality is, I pay tribute to the Prime Minister for going back and trying to get better terms. I've had a look at the exchange of letters, and it makes it very clear that there's no legal change to the withdrawal agreement or the Northern Ireland Protocol. So if you want a better Brexit deal, if you want a better Brexit, we do have to, as MPs, vote down the deal tomorrow. And what I hope I've sought to do is sketch out why there is a positive, optimistic alternative to that.
Before we go back to our friends in the media.
Hi, I'm Sophie Jarvis from the Adam Smith Institute. Your free market competitive utopia sounds wonderful and also fair, but do you think it's reasonable that some people are concerned that it could, all this sort of Tory infighting, and if we don't actually Brexit at all, that could lead to a Corbyn government, which is obviously not what you want?
Yes, I think there's risks on all sides in whatever we do, and that's why I said at the start of my speech, I think we need to gauge very carefully the risks in every different possible route. But we also need to think about the opportunities and balance the short term with the long term. And I think that the biggest risk for us will be to locked in to this deal that's being proposed with the democratic cliff edge that it presents. And I think if people want a better deal, then they need to vote against it tomorrow. And the biggest risk of a Jeremy Corbyn government, I think, will be succumbing to this deal, because in the lead up to the next election, we would be trapped in a bad regime without the economic competitiveness, which is one of the opportunities of Brexit, without the ability to do free trade deals, and without control over vast swathes of our laws. And I think that is the biggest risk of a Jeremy Corbyn government.